Okay, recording in progress. So it is Tuesday, March 31st, 2026. Got a decade ahead of myself there. It's okay. Wonder how many I was in my perverse Buddhist mind. When I went to the baseball game last Friday, I was like, in 100 years, all these people will be dead. Anyway, happy days. Okay, well, we will start with a period of meditation, and I'll give a little guidance to get us started with that. And just again, welcome to everybody who's showing up on a Tuesday to practice. And so, yeah, just settling back into a comfortable meditation posture. If you can be upright and in balance, that's helpful. It's also fine to lie down if you need to do that. I would say if you don't have a physical need for that, a health need, that it's more conducive to focused concentration, to clear a clear mind, to be upright. And you can close your eyes or just lower your gaze. No need to be looking at the screen. One of the gifts of meditation is that we get to turn away from screens for a little while. Even when we're meditating on Zoom, we don't have to look at the screen. And then turning the attention to the inner life, the physical and mental inner life. First, just feeling the body, feeling how you're holding your body, your posture, the alignment. Noticing any tightness or tension that you're creating and seeing if you can release that. Until a sense of settling. Might imagine the whole body being drawn toward the earth, feeling the gravity. Releasing the shoulders, softening the belly. And bringing in awareness of the breath in the body. The breath moving, breathing in, breathing out. And again, it's a sense of softening in the body. And that really just working toward feeling of calm, whatever might be in your mind, realizing that you can still release tension through the body, settle the nervous system with the breath. The gentle rhythmic movement of breath. Now, when we bring the breath into the foreground of our awareness, the breath and the body, we can find a way to just allow thoughts to pass through like background. Static. Not letting their ideas draw us in. Just letting it all go. Letting the pleasant experience of the present moment, mindful breathing. Letting that draw the attention. That be in the foreground of awareness. If you do find yourself caught up in thinking, losing touch with the breath and the body, it's quite natural. Just acknowledge that and then gently come back. Each time we come back to the breath from the wandering mind, it takes a little time to reestablish the awareness of the body, the breath. I'm trying to be patient, letting that process unfold. It's like starting again, feeling the posture, feeling the tensions or areas of discomfort in the body, breathing into those experiences. Letting the breath become the focal point again. You may find that each time you come back, there's a little bit more settling that happens. And the breath is, first of all, an object of mindfulness, something to pay attention to that has no content, just a neutral experience. And we can also use the breath to open what is tight or closed as we inhale, to soften and release as we exhale. Okay. Hello, welcome again, everyone. We're on the verge of April Fool's Day, aren't we? Good thing it's not today. Because I wouldn't know what to do. The Dharma that I listen to, and I hope that you all listen to Dharma regularly. A great way to just keep it in mind. And not can't overdo it. I just will say side note, like. Somebody was sort of saying something about how I talk about suttas or something as though I were spending my days, just paging through texts. And I find that there's only so much really you can take in at a time. And it's in a way to me better to keep it simple, to just have a couple of themes that you kind of pick up each day and not try to sort of, engorge yourself with spiritual teachings as if that's going to somehow solve something. Anyway, side note. I listen to Ajahn Amaro's podcast, which is like my podcast, is not really a podcast, just recordings of his talks. And he's been so if you don't know who Ajahn Amaro is, well, put his name in the chat so that Ajahn is an honorific that monks in basically in Thailand are given that honorific after they've been monks for or not well monks I don't know that nuns get that for 10 years and it's actually 10 rains retreats is the technical thing anyway and Amaro is his so this is monastic name actually means deathless and was one of the co-founders and co-abbots of Abhayagiri Monastery up near Ukiah, and is now the abbot of the Amaravati Monastery in England, but he's been he on sabbatical for the last year, and I believe today might be the last day of his sabbatical, and because this is the last day of the rains retreat, as it's sort of followed in at least in the Ajahn Chah Thai forest tradition in the West. And because I think in this is really, anyway, just information. I believe that in Asia, the rains retreat is like in the fall. I think the rainy season in India, somebody here probably knows this better than I, but something like, like July to September or August to November or something. Anyway, but once they set up monasteries in the West, it seemed, I think they figured winter was a better time to have their rains retreat, so-called rains retreat, because it was originally set up because of the climate patterns in South Asia, in India, that the monastics, the monks in the Buddhist time wouldn't stay in one place for long periods of time. Generally, they'd be kind of traveling and teaching, and so when it was rainy, it wasn't practical for them to do that. And so the Buddha kind of was like, well, that's a good time. We'll have a retreat each year for those 3 months. And it also had something to do with like the rice fields that the monks would sort of bumble into a rice field and anger the farmers. So it was partly to make sure everybody didn't cause trouble in the community, in the farming community. And here I go. I didn't know I was going to talk about this, but I'm getting somewhere. I have a topic. It's coming. Don't worry. But I like this technical stuff. It's kind of for me. I don't. I hope people find it somewhat interesting, just to sort of know a little bit about these historic sort of frameworks for the Dharma. So the monks are not allowed to travel during that time, so they have to stay in one place, and that's when really they started to develop monasteries. I mean, the monks didn't build the monasteries. The lay people would say, "Oh, if you're going to stay here for a while, we'll build some huts for you, and we'll have a meditation hall." And then we have the famous monastery at Jetta's Grove, but not at Pintakas Park in Savatthi, where many of the Buddhist suttas were delivered. And there's in this fact about the fact that they couldn't travel is kind of particularly mentioned in the Anapanasati Sutta, the Sutta on the mindfulness of breathing. So the Sutta begins where the Buddha has been at a particular monastery, I believe, not the Jetta's Grove, but Crosstown in the eastern part of Savatthi, I think. Anyway, he starts the sutta by talking about how they've been practicing for 3 months, and that the monastics that he's been meditating with, he feels they're making a lot of progress, and he wants them to keep going. So he says, "I'm going to extend the retreat for another month." But what's particularly then interesting is that because all the monastics who were not at that particular monastery at that time hear about this, and they come flocking in because they hadn't been able to be with the Buddha for the last 3 months. Because it's kind of like musical chairs. The rains retreat starts wherever you are. You stop and you stay there. So all these, monastics who are in outlying areas come to the monastery to practice, and that's then the Buddha teaches then the mindfulness of breathing practice, the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, and he leads up to doing that by describing all the ways people are practicing, and then he says, "And this is what I'm kind of recommending for this month long." Additional month we're going to practice together. And there are various places in the suttas where the Buddha says that's his practice. There's a point where he says to Ananda, his attendant, "If people ask you what I'm doing when I'm away," because he's about to go on a retreat for a little while in this particular sutta, "if people ask you what I'm doing for practice, what will you tell them?" And Ananda says, "I don't know. What should I tell them? Tell them that I'm practicing mindful breathing, So it seems to be, his practice, not the only one that he did or that he taught, but his primary practice. Okay, I'm circling back to Ajahn Amaro, but there's a collection, all his podcast, of course, everything is at least a year old on there. And so I've listened to some of those talks more than once. And he has a series where he goes through the book that he co-wrote with Ajahn Pasano called The Island. And I have it right here. It's a free book. It's an The Island, in the subtitle, is an anthology of the Buddhist teachings on Nibbana. It's quite a remarkable book and very technical and challenging, and a lot of things that are very advanced, but beautiful. And as with anything, any Buddhist teaching that, you can be reading along going, I don't know what this means. I don't know what this is. It's too complicated. Then something simple thing will just land and you, oh, that, okay. So it's worth reading. The first half of the book is Ajahn Amaro's half, and the second half is Ajahn Pasano's. And the book really exemplifies the difference in their approaches and their Ajahn Amaro, much more technical and complex, deep stuff on sort of emptiness and, this section I was reading today and that I was listening to him talk about yesterday. Is the chapter called Unsupported and Unsupportive Consciousness. And it's talking about just trying to define the word consciousness and what did the Buddha mean by that? And where's this particular phrase? Consciousness that is signless, boundless, all luminous. So it's like one of the lines that he's sort of expounding on. Consciousness that is signless, boundless, all luminous. So you just a line like that, right away you're in very deep. Like, what are we talking about, right? Signless, boundless, all luminous consciousness. And maybe I'll come back to that a little bit and give my own sort of take on it. But the funny thing about this particular talk I was listening to yesterday is that Ajahn Pasano is also on the recording, and I'm not sure if he's on Zoom or if they're in the same place. I think maybe Ajahn Pasano is on Zoom, and it was because I think it was right before Ajahn Amaro was going to go on this year-long sabbatical, and Ajahn Pasano went over to Amaravati to take over as the abbot while Ajahn Amaro was away. And so ostensibly they're on this together, but 95% of the talking is Ajahn Amaro. Like, once in a while he'll say, do you have anything to add? Ajahn Pasano will be like, yeah, I think that was fine. That'll be about it. But he came up with, but the I Ajahn Pasano sometimes says the thing that really actually stands out, because it's not about, signless, boundless, all luminous consciousness. He said, after they'd been talking about, after Amaro had been talking about something about practice and talking about sort of feeling states, and Ajahn Pasano said, well, I think it's best to practice mindfulness of the body, because the body mirrors the mind. The body is a mirror of the mind. And, that landed for me, because that's how I practice. It's much of what I teach here. And then he said, when, and I'm paraphrasing here, when you try to pay attention to the mind, you're basically always looking at it in retrospect. He said, by then, the train's already left the station, which is exactly, I think, right, that when we try to be mindful of the mind, or I should, let me just say mindful of thoughts, but we can talk about more But just to start with that, when you're mindful of thoughts, you're only mindful that you just had a thought, right? It's very difficult to be mindful as you were having a thought. Like you can be mindful as you were breathing and as you were feeling a sensation in your body. And you can be mindful of an emotion in the body. But it's very difficult. I'm not saying it can't be done, but it's very difficult to be mindful as you're thinking. And, that I think is, well, I mean, to debate why that is, but essentially, my take on it is that thoughts, we identify and lock onto thoughts so strongly that it's very difficult to separate our awareness from the thought and be aware of the thought. We're just in the thought. In any case, the body is a mirror of the mind is a great like mantra or just guidance for meditation. So realizing that when you're being mindful of your body, of what's going on through your senses, through the feelings, that one of the things you are experiencing is the resonance of mental states. The mental states are having a, well, they're being mirrored, as he uses the term, but I would say to get a little bit closer to that, that they're being felt. Mental states are being felt in the body. And so this is why working with those feeling states is the most, I will say, most effective way. This is my opinion, most effective way of working with mind states. That when we breathe with a feeling that's being triggered by a thought, we're able to move that feeling energetically with the breath. And, I talk about this a lot about how the breath, interacts with the nervous system. And of course, when we're talking about and here again, I think we can say in this sense, this is the link. We're talking about the nervous, what we call the nervous system, which, and these are just constructs because it's not like there's this separation, but the nervous system is like the link between the mind states, the thoughts, and I guess we could say emotions, and the body. I mean, nervous system is in the body, but so is the brain. So, but that when we have just sensed something in the body, I feel a sensation, we'll just say a sensation. And if it's a sensation that's triggered by a thought, that thought has activated the nervous system, and then we feel it as a sensation. Okay? Hope this is making sense. And this is just Kevin's like way of putting this together. It might not be scientifically 100% accurate, but I think it's a functional way of viewing this. So you've got this thing that thought, which we'll say part of the brain that triggers the nervous system, activates the nervous system, like some energy gets activated because we had this thought, feel something about it. And then we're coming at, we're being mindful of the body and we feel this sensation, which is the activated nervous system. And then maybe we take a deep breath. And through the breath is able then to go back and like, this conversation between the mind and the breath, shall we say, it goes back, the breath goes back to deactivate the nervous system. And then the deactivated nervous system then tends to settle, allow the mind to settle. And this is, in fact, what the Buddha describes in the Sutta on mindfulness of breathing. He starts out by saying, be aware of your breath. And then he says, be aware of your whole body and your breath. So now he's right? He's opening up to like, oh, what am I feeling in my body? I'm still breathing. I'm still aware of my breathing and I'm feeling my body. And then he says, now calm the body with that breath. And then the next stage is the feeling realm. And he talks about how, if you're getting concentrated, you can start to have these energetic experiences, this PT and Sukha. And then he says to bring awareness to how thoughts are arising out of those energetic states. So here he's kind of putting a particular focus on how the energetic states get interpreted and trigger thinking. And then he says, and all of this is, you're supposed to be doing this with along with awareness of the breath. And then he says, and this is this, to calm those mind states, those that have arisen, to calm the energetic states, the mental states, the thoughts that are arising, calm them using the breath. And that's just what I was talking about how the breath has this relationship then across the nervous system and the mind states. And again, how Ajahn Pasano is just giving us this clue about, oh, if something's going on here, I'm aware of something happening in my feeling realm. It's mirroring mind states. But if I try to go to my mind and stop my thoughts by thinking, then I just get into this battle with my mind. Instead, we move through the body into this process. And it's funny how, I was thinking about, oh, if I quote this, like I don't really have the quote, and I'd have to like search through this podcast trying to find this one line where Ajahn Pasano says something, or all the rest of the time Ajahn Amaro is talking. So I'm kind of tempted to go back and try to transcribe some of it. Let me then go back to this line from Ajahn Amaro. We have a little more time. Taking us into a completely different direction, if you don't mind. So I'll just read this paragraph. One of the ways in which the Buddha characterized the quality of awareness was to present it as a form of consciousness or vijnana. This represents a unique usage of the term. Customarily, vijnana only refers to the conditioned activity of the six senses. However, we also find that the Buddha gives us some adjectives with which to describe it. When the term is used in this unique way, vijnanam anidasanam anattam sabbato padam, consciousness, and then quote, translating that as consciousness that is signless, boundless, all luminous, is one translation of this expression. It almost goes without saying that there is controversy as to the precise meaning of this enigmatic phrase. It appears in only a couple of places in the canon, Majjhima 49 and Digha Nikaya 11. However, the constellation of meanings of the individual words is small enough to give us a reasonably clear idea of what the Buddha was pointing at. So, hard to find a place to stop here. I'll read a little more. Firstly, we must assume that he is using vijnana in a broader way than it usually is meant. The Buddha avoided the nitpicking pedantry of many philosophers contemporary with him and opted for a more broad-brush colloquial style geared to particular listeners in a language which they could understand. Thus, vijnana here can be assumed to mean knowing, but not the partial, fragmented, discriminative knowing, which the word usually implies. Instead, it must mean a knowing of a primordial, transcendent nature. Otherwise, the passage which contains it would be self-contradictory. So you can get just a flavor of where Ajahn Amaro likes to go with this stuff. So I'll just look at these two lines. Consciousness that is signless, boundless, all luminous, and a knowing that is primordial, of a primordial transcendent nature. So what we're talking about here, it the language is so high, and it sounds so sort of inaccessible, but it's not really. Signless, boundless, all luminous consciousness is talking about when the mind gets very quiet. Signless means that you're not naming anything with your mind. You're not using language to identify any experience. You're just having a pure experience. Just this. Just isness, suchness, being. And even all of that, again, sounds so like fancy. But if you're meditating, and I know many of you have been on retreats, and you get into a really quiet space where it's kind of like all the meditation instructions kind of fall away. Like you're not really doing anything. You know, like when you're meditating and you're like, oh, I'm noting my thinking, or I'm noting my breath, or I'm doing loving kindness phrases, or I'm noticing, oh, that's a sound, oh, that's a bird. No, you're not doing any of that. You just get to this place where everything just kind of quiets down, and it's like your mind just feels spacious and quiet and empty. And then, you know, it could last a couple seconds, could last a couple minutes. Usually such things don't last long unless you're really developing a lot of concentration. But you can see why you could just call that state signless. So there's nothing, again, just this technical language, signless. You're not naming anything. You're not identifying what's happening. It's boundless. It's all luminous, you know. It just feels like, wow, you're just in space, right? A knowing of a primordial transcendent nature. You experience this and you go, oh, like my ordinary way of being in the world is kind of busy. You know, there's a lot going on in the mind, and there's a lot of words and thoughts and figuring things out and planning and deciding. But when all that stops, there's something else there. It's not like there's nothing there. There's this mind. There's this, as Buddha calls it, consciousness. There is this awareness. And, you know, and it's beautiful. And when we have those moments, they're really precious to us. And we, you know, we can't help but, well, I mean, there's a great temptation in those moments to, or after those moments, to want to get it back and to value it as a, but this is where, you know, really being immersed in the teachings and understanding impermanence and clinging becomes really important, because that experience, like every experience we can have, is impermanent. It can't last. It can't be held on to. It can't be retained. It can't even be repeated. And so if we view the experience itself as the important thing, we're pointing slightly in the wrong direction, and that can take us far, far away from the path if we keep following that. In other words, we go, oh, I need to just keep going on retreats so that I can keep experiencing this thing, because when I experience this thing, then it's special, then I'm enlightened, then whatever. No. The way what we're meant to get from this, if we as Buddhist practitioners, is the insight into realizing that everything that goes on in my life is actually happening out of this primordial space. That is always there. I can't hold on to it, but everything that I'm experiencing is just a creation of mind that's temporary, that comes and goes, has no substance, is not satisfactory, right? The three characteristics. And that is meant to change how you experience your life, how you understand your life, how you interpret your life, and how you move through your life by seeing, the typical term is the empty nature of things, but just having, in other words, having a glimpse of it is all you need. You don't need to hold on to this experience, as pleasant and potentially blissful as it can be. That's not the point. And which is difficult, because when you have a blissful experience, it's very difficult to not think, oh, I should keep doing that. And this might sound similar to something else you're familiar which is addiction, right? We get high and we think, got it, finally figured out life. The way to live is to have this drink every day, have this, smoke this stuff every day, snort this, inject this, drop this, eat this, fuck this, gamble on this, shop, buy this, accumulate this, whatever your addiction is, whatever the thing is that you have moments of transcendence, of like, oh God, life is good. And so it's very seductive, and it's really important. It's important and really valuable to have these experiences, to not just read about it, but to have it so that it becomes something in you that you can draw upon to remember, in the sense of mindfulness, and sati, like, oh, what's happening now is this, and seeing everything. And so the term I use is seeing our experience through the lens of Dharma rather than through the lens of self. And so it's seeing and this is one of the aspects of the lens of Dharma, is realizing that all this experience is, underneath it, there is this foundation of this primordial, empty, signless consciousness. So let's we'll just remember that the body mirrors the mind, and then we can make a connection maybe between those two teachings. But I don't have time to do that right now, so I'm gonna let it go. So thank you for your attention. I will note that it's 11 o'clock here in the Pacific time zone. I will stay on here for a few more minutes, but I understand if people need to leave. So, but if anybody wanted to chime in and say something, it looks like you've got a very pale hand up there, John.
Yes, I do.
Well, it's blending
The
into your butt wall, so it.
There we go. How's that look? So my question is, you, and this is really simple. I just need you to repeat something. You said everything I'm experiencing is a creation of mine. Is that a fair relaying of that, what you said, or something like?
Yeah, and it's not quite the accurate way of saying it. My experience of it all is through the mind. It might be a better way of saying it. It's, in other words, we don't directly experience anything because the senses take it in and then mind interprets it and gives us, presents us with how it understands what we're experiencing. Is that making sense? I'm not.
Yeah, no, I understand. I get the idea.
It's sort of the flip of the beginning of the Dhammapada, where it says mind is the forerunner of all things. And now that really would just take us somewhere else.
Well, it fits in with what you said that, what I think I'm seeing may not necessarily be what is.
Right. Yeah. So the senses. I'm not like feeling that sharp
That's okay.
deconstruct this, but so our senses have limited capacities. For instance, our eyes can only see a certain spectrum, right? Our he ears can only hear a certain spectrum of sound, even though we know that those things exist beyond our sensibilities. So that's, first of all, the first way that we're interpreting things, and then the mind does all this stuff through memory and perception and interpretation and analysis and judgment and bias to feed it to us as like, this is what's happening. So the guy I was talking about before we started the recording, who tried to kill his father because he was psychotic, his mind was telling him that his father was like Satan. So, our minds tell us stuff. Bridget.
Hi, Kevin. Thank
Hi.
you so much. I loved this talk because I have such an addictive personality. I love what you said at the end. I have such an addictive personality. I often worry that this is just another thing that I'm becoming attached to, in terms of the Dharma and meditation. And so can you tell, you said, I think you said at the end something like, make sure you're just viewing it through the lens of the Dharma instead of the lens of the self.
Yeah.
Could you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it's a critical idea.